chapter 2, if you've got your Bibles, 106:4 is the page. And we're in this series on seeing Jesus afresh, taking passages from the gospel and looking at Jesus. And so this morning we're asking the question, what does this passage tell us about Jesus? How might we see Jesus afresh? And this is a really, really important passage because I don't know if you noticed verse 11, what Jesus did here at Cana of Galilee at this wedding was the first of his signs. And in John's gospel, this story that John writes about Jesus, scholars think they sometimes debate this, but there's at least sort of seven signs that happen. And each of these signs, as it says here, revealed something of his glory. Now, John has told us at the beginning of his gospel that Jesus has glory, and only some people see it. Like, everybody sees Jesus, but only some people see his glory. But this is one of the moments where his glory is revealed, and people see it. And so the question we've got to ask ourselves is, why on earth, how on earth is Jesus's glory revealed here? And it's the first of Jesus's signs. It's the first one. So this is actually really, really important, because first impressions are important. Is that right? First impressions are important. And this is the first of Jesus's signs. I was reading a couple of years ago, The Guardian did an article about interview horror stories, right? So you're going for a job interview, and terrible things that happen to people. And obviously, first impressions at an interview are really, really important. And I got a couple here just to read you, and just to remind you of how important first impressions can be. And you can cringe away at these. So this is the first one. I once interviewed a very nervous chap who had a terrible interview. It was embarrassing for all concerned, really. He got up to leave the room, and by accident, he opened the wrong door and walked right into the stationery cupboard. The panel sat waiting for him to emerge, and when he didn't, my colleague went to investigate. The poor man was so mortified by what had happened, he was trying to climb out of the window rather than go back in. He didn't get the job. Here's another one. My interview was going too well, far too well. I had sat there for 55 minutes with them firing questions at me and me firing answers right back. The nods confirmed it. I was doing really well. I had made a great impression. I was pretty certain that I got the job. They wrapped it up and I stood up to shake my hand. As I went to stand up myself, I realized that for 55 minutes solid, I had sat with my legs crossed, unmoved. Needless to say, my legs locked. I didn't make it into a standing position. I crashed headfirst into a filing cabinet. I didn't get the job, okay? First impressions are really, really important. And the question we've got to ask here is, why on earth does Jesus choose this moment to be his first sign? What is going on here? This is a wedding and there's wine. Why on earth, how on earth does this reveal something significant about Jesus? It's strange. One scholar puts it like this. Why would Jesus' first sign be to rescue a young couple from an awkward social situation by providing good quality alcohol? It's a good question to ask. What's going on here? But I think there is something here, and the scholars really wrestle with it. They sort of don't quite know how to make sense of this. This doesn't seem good enough to be Jesus's first sign. But I think this is incredibly rich, and I think the Bible wants us to see how rich this is. And I think we see three things in this passage about Jesus, three things about him. I think, first of all, we see what Jesus offers, what Jesus offers. Second, he shows us how he will get it for us. And third, he shows us how we will receive it. So what he offers, how he'll get it for us, and how we will receive it. So first of all, what he offers, what he offers. What God is offering here through Jesus Christ in this passage is nothing more than an experience of his abundant and overwhelming love. What Jesus offers here is nothing less than experience of his abundant and overwhelming love. Now, Jesus knows his Old Testament, right? He knows his Old Testament very well. And he knows that a wedding is an image of God's relationship to his people all the way through the Old Testament. God keeps talking about marriage as an image of his relationship to his people. And so Jesus is sat at this wedding and he's thinking about a different wedding. You know, sometimes when you're sat in a wedding and you're sort of enjoying the wedding, but you're also thinking about another wedding. Maybe it's your own wedding. Maybe if you're unmarried, you might be thinking about the wedding you hope that one day you might have. But your eyes are sort of elsewhere. Your attention is elsewhere. And I picture Jesus sat in this wedding, but he's thinking about another wedding, a greater wedding. He knows his Old Testament. So Isaiah 62, 2-5, we read this morning at the 9 o'clock service. Isaiah says this in chapter 62. If you want to turn back to Isaiah, you can. But Isaiah 62, the nations will see your vindication. All the kings will see your glory. You'll be called God's people by a new name that the mouth of the Lord will bestow. You, God's people, us, will be a crown of splendor in the Lord's hand, a royal crown in the hand of your God. And then listen to this. No longer will they call you deserted, but you will be called Hespazar, which means my delight is in her. And your land will be called Beulah, which means married. For the Lord will take delight in you, and your land will be married. As a young man marries a young woman, so will your builder marry you. As a bridegroom rejoices over his bride, so will God rejoice over you. God's relationship to his people is like that of a groom to his bride. And the whole, as I say, the whole of scriptures keep doing this again and again. There's a whole book of the Bible called Hosea, which really plays off this, really just a play of this whole image of sort of a bride and a bridegroom and God's faithfulness and what happens when the bride is unfaithful and God being faithful. Revelation 19:7 says, so we've got the Old Testament, we've got Jesus in the middle, and then right at the end of the show in Revelation chapter 19, the whole show is wrapped up, and the language it uses is of a marriage feast. How do we on earth describe the kingdom that's to come? And the image the scriptures use is of a marriage feast where wine and food will flow. That's the image scriptures use. And all of this, like I say, is tied to wine. Wine, again, flows through all of these passages. By the way, I just want to say, I'm talking about marriage today and I'm talking about wine. And it's important to say that none of these images for us are sort of neutral images. None of these images are perfect images. I'm well aware that many of us actually have had bad experiences of marriage, either our own marriages or marriages of our mums and dads or marriages of others in our family. I'm also well aware that many of us have had bad experiences of alcohol, that alcohol might not be a particularly helpful image for us at this phase of our life. Many of us, our lives or lives of those we know, have been affected, even ruined by alcohol. But I'm going to keep using the images because the images are so precious. They're also so precious that when they get hurt, they hurt even more. There's no reason to let go of the images. So maybe today there's a bit of sort of redemption of these images for you as well. But I'm going to keep using the images, marriage and wine. They're painful because they're so powerful. 247 times in the Bible references alcohol. Most of those references are about wine. 40 of those references are neutral, but 145 are positive. The Bible actually has a really positive view of wine, and it often uses wine to talk about the great thing that God is doing. Again, we could go through the passages in the Old Testament where God talks about the abundance of wine. In Amos, the days are coming, declares the Lord, when new wine will drip from the mountains and flow from all the hills. And so wine is an image of the new thing that God is doing. It's an image of his abundance. You know, in our passage we had this morning, the amount of water that Jesus turns into wine is a huge amount. Scholars have sort of studied this in their studies, and one scholar says it's over 2,000 glasses of wine that Jesus produces, an extraordinary amount. And then later on, verse 10, you know, everyone brings out the choice wine first and then the cheaper wine after the guests have had too much to drink. In other words, when they're a little bit tipsy and a little bit drunk, they don't really care what wine they're drinking at that point. So you bring out the bad wine then. But you've left the best wine till the end. So this isn't just any wine. This is beautiful wine, a fine vintage. We've got a lot of it, and it's wonderful. And I hope you see this morning in this passage, you see, therefore, what Jesus is offering. And right at the start of his ministry, what he's saying is, what I am about is about the abundance of God's goodness. About the abundance of God's goodness. We looked at this over Christmas, didn't we? We were talking about the fact that, you know, every good gift comes from God. And I said on Christmas Day, I really hope when you go home today and you eat and you drink and you feast, that you will remember that all of this is a sign to us of God's abundant generosity to us. I hope you will remember that God is the source of all of those good things. John 10:10, Jesus says, I have come that they might have life and have it to the full. Now, I don't know whether this feels like Christianity to you. I don't know where you are on that journey. Perhaps when you think of Christianity, you don't think of abundant life. You don't think of joy, of celebration, for all sorts of reasons. Some of us have had bad experiences of church, bad experiences of religion. But I hope you see that what Jesus is offering here is nothing less than life and life to the full. And I wonder if there's some of us who maybe we sort of do faith over here and we have all sorts of good things in our lives over here. Holidays, times with family, hobbies we enjoy, festivals, celebrations, sport, all of these good things. And we've never quite sort of matched the two things up in our lives. You know, it doesn't feel like if you sort of pointed out where's the deepest joy in your life, you sort of wouldn't necessarily lean to the faith element, you'd lean to all the other bits. And I think what Jesus is saying is, what I'm about, everything I'm about, is about the fullness of joy. The fullness of joy. Not happiness. Not, you know, a sort of bouncing around like we're happy constantly. Joy is a happiness that isn't dependent on circumstances. A happiness that isn't dependent on circumstances. This sort of deep sense of joy that whatever we're going through, and some of us are going through really, really tough things, that whatever we're going through, we just sort of know this deep joy of the Father, that the Father delights in us. And that one day there will be a feast that you and I are invited to. And we get these sort of little tastes of it all the way through our lives. And there'll be a feast that we'll enjoy one day that's to come. And, you know, I use that word experience quite deliberately, that this is an experience of God's goodness. The reason I use that word experience is there is something about this which is more than just a head thing. You know, when Mary comes to Jesus and says, "Son, they've run out of wine." And Jesus says, "Woman," which by the way is not an insult. You can see at the bottom of your Bibles there, it says not an insult. He's just saying, you know, my dear, my lovely one. Don't worry. What Jesus doesn't say is like, don't worry about it. It's fine. You know, I'm the King of Kings. I'm the Lord of Lords. Just trust me. Right? He gives them an experience of his goodness. Right? He doesn't say, don't worry, everything's fine, I'm good. Just have some faith. And you know, the wedding's going to end early, but that's okay. He says, no, experience my goodness. Psalm 34, taste and see that the Lord is good. There's something about the goodness of God that you can't quite put into words, that transcends words. This experiential thing, you feel it in your heart, you feel it in your mind. That's what we're invited into today. And you know, I think, when you've had it, because you begin to hunger for it. That's when I think you know that you're experiencing the goodness of God, because you begin to hunger for it. And some of you are on that journey and you're already beginning to hunger for the goodness of God. You know, hunger coming to church and hearing the Bible, hungering to get up and pray, hungering to worship because you've tasted something of the goodness of God. And I don't know where you are, whether that's a new thing for you, whether you once tasted it and it feels like it's faded away a little bit more. There's an invitation for us this morning to experience the goodness of God. Maybe some of you have rejected Christianity offhand. Maybe you're here this morning, you've rejected Christianity offhand because you think Christianity is boring and dull. I want you just to see from this passage, Jesus is offering the fullness of life. There's lots of good reasons to reject Christianity. This isn't one of them. Right? Jesus is full of life and life to the full. That's the first thing. What he offers, fullness of life. But second, what this passage shows us as well is what Jesus will do to get it for us. There's a really strange moment in this passage where Mary comes to Jesus and says, they've run out of wine. She's got a clear problem. It's a good prayer to pray. I'm just telling you, Jesus, what I see. They've run out of wine. This is an issue. And then Jesus says, verse 4, why do you involve me? My hour has not yet come. What a strange reply. But then, obviously, a couple of verses later, we see that he does act. And so you've got this weird thing where you're like, it seems to be Jesus is saying, this is nothing to do with me. And then a couple of verses later, he's like, he's doing the thing. We can't treat Jesus like that. We can't sort of see him as somebody who just changes his mind in an instant. You know, I'm not going to do that. And then he does it. John's being quite deliberate here with this language. And he's talking about the hour. Jesus' first response is about the hour. And like I said, I've pictured Jesus sat here, and as this wedding is going on, he's thinking about this other wedding, but he's also particularly thinking about his own wedding, right? His own marriage, and what it will cost him to become the bridegroom for us. And this word hour that's used in John's gospel is like a little code word, and John drops it in all the way through the gospel several times. And the hour is related to something that's about to happen to Jesus later on in his ministry, where Jesus is going to go to the cross and die for us. In John 12:27, Jesus says, "Should I ask the Father to save me from this hour?" John 13, verse 1, Jesus knew that his hour had come. And then when he's on the cross looking up to heaven, Jesus says, "Father, the hour has come. Glorify your Son." What's Jesus talking about? He's talking about his death. That's what he's talking about. He's talking about his death. And so Mary comes and says, "Jesus, there's no more wine." And Jesus says, "Mom, it's not my hour. I'm not ready to die yet." What's the connection between wine and hour? Well, the other image that's used for the Old Testament of wine again and again is the wine of God's anger, of his wrath, the wine of the punishment that's to come for sins, the judgment that's to come on sins. And we believe that Jesus Christ, for us, for you and me, out of great love, where there was a consequence for sins, Jesus chooses to step into that and receive the consequence himself. That's what Jesus is talking about here. And he talks in the other Gospels about the wine that is to his to drink, the cup that he must drink from. And so here's Jesus in a wedding, surrounded by people drinking wine, and he's thinking of the wedding that's to come, the great wedding, and how this is a foretaste of it. And then the wine runs out, and Jesus, in that moment where the wine runs out, what goes through his head is, this is exactly what's happened to creation. You know, this is like an image of creation. God has created a beautiful world with abundance. That's what an image of wedding is. And if you ask Jews today, even today, they would talk about Adam and Eve as the bride and the bridegroom. You know, it's an image of creation and all that God came to do. And then there's this lack of wine, and Jesus is thinking, this is exactly what happens to creation. This wonderful world that God creates gets broken, and now there's lack. And Jesus in that moment realizes, again, this is what it's going to cost to put that right. This is the consequence of that brokenness. And so he talks about his hour. This is what he's talking about. And so in this moment, Jesus speaks of his hour. Someone must drink the cup. There is a judgment that must be realized. And he's thinking that in order to get the wine of the kingdom, the feast, I will have to go through the hour. I will drink the cup so that you can enjoy the feast. That's what we see here. And each of us needs to hear that this morning. What Jesus has done for us to receive the feast that's to come is that he has drunk the cup for us. That's the truth of the gospel. The preacher Tim Keller said this: "He, Jesus, sits amongst the joy, sipping the cup of coming sorrow, so that we, you and me, can sit amidst the sorrow, sipping the cup of coming joy." It's a rich phrase. He sits amidst the joy, sipping the cup of coming sorrow, so that we can sit amongst the sorrow, sipping the cup of coming joy. Jesus suffers for us. Do you see the depth of his love for you and for me? Jesus offers the abundance of life, and he will go through all of that so that we can receive it. Finally, how do you and I receive that? How do you and I today receive that? I want to talk at a couple of levels here. The first level I want to talk to is for those of us who have been on this journey of faith for a while, right? Have been journeying with Christ for some time. And I just want you to notice something. Mary comes to Jesus and she prays what's a really, really good prayer. She just describes the situation. "Lord, there's no more wine." And sometimes our prayers are like that. We don't know what to pray, but we just know things are bad. "Lord, Israel and Gaza. I don't know what to pray. I'm just telling it, Lord, right? Ukraine, there's no more wine." And Mary says, Jesus says, "My hour has not yet come." And then what does Mary reply? I love this. Verse 5, "Do whatever he tells you to do." Do whatever he tells you to do. And some of us this morning, if we've been on this journey a long time, just need to hear that. David was preaching this morning at the 9, and he said these words: "The abundance is connected to obedience." The abundance at some level is connected to obedience. Now, this isn't about us earning God's favor or earning God's grace, but God is desperate to pour out his abundance on your life. And there might just be that there's some things in our life that are currently stopping us from receiving that abundance. And I just want to challenge you this morning. If there's something in your life that's maybe stopping you from receiving the fullness of Christ, if you know that Jesus is asking something of you and you're refusing it, if he's maybe called you to something and you're saying no, if he's maybe asking something of you and you're resistant, hear Mary's words: "Do whatever he tells you to do." If you do whatever Jesus tells you to do, abundance will flow. That's the first point. Second point, it's at the point where they run out of wine that the abundance flows. It's at the point where they run out of wine that the abundance flows. And I think what we need to see this morning, whether we're new to this journey or whether we've been on it a long time, is that, as I've said before, it will be at the point of our lack that Jesus is able to do a new thing. It will be at the point of our weakness that Jesus is able to bring new wine. It won't be at the point of our strength. You know, this morning at the 9 o'clock service, we arrived and we were here early and we set up and the screens stopped working, the technology stopped working. And so we didn't have any screens. So we sort of, you know, we had to blag it a little bit and we sung some choruses and all of that. And it was absolutely fine. And it struck me that, you know, we were reading this, they have no more wine. I said to the congregation, we have no more technology, right? And God does a new thing. God does a new thing in that moment. For us as a church and for us as individuals. So for us as a church, first of all, there was a wise abbot once in a monastery, a young novice comes to him and he says, Father, I've got good news and I've got some bad news. And the abbot says, okay, you choose whichever you want to tell me first. And the novice says this. He says, the monastery's just been given £1 million by a local donor. We can rebuild the chapel. We can advertise for new novices. We can renovate the sleeping quarters. And this wise abbot looks at him and he says, wonderful. What's the good news? Right. God, you know, we can have everything that we think we need. Staff, money, resources, SVF money, all the rest of it, right? Where are the points of our lack? Because it will be at that moment that God is able to do a new thing in our church. It will be at that moment that the new wine comes. Right? That's the moment. And so I don't know what it's going to look like for us over the next few weeks, months. I don't know if the church has to get smaller, has to get bigger. I don't know what we have to let go of, what we have to lose. I don't know where God's taking us on that journey. But I do know when we reach the point of dependence on him, where we're not dependent on our resources, where we're dependent on his resources, when the wine runs out will be the moment that God's able to do a new thing. And it will be a new thing. You know, they could have had enough wine and everybody would have said, oh, what a lovely wedding. This was really, really good. And they would have gone home. But it's because the wine runs out that there's an astonishing thing that happens. And it's in our Bibles and we're talking about it 2,000 years later. That's for us as a church. And what about for you as an individual? For you as an individual, may you know that the point at which you are reaching the point of your suffering might be the point at which Jesus is bringing new wine into your life. And this isn't easy to say. I'm not saying this because, you know, you're going through a hard thing and God caused it. We don't believe that at all. But we do believe that in the midst of our challenges, in the midst of our difficulties, Jesus is able to do a new thing. If you feel in your life today that the wine has run out in your life, whatever that looks like, I don't know what that looks like for you. If you feel like the wine has run out, that you've reached the limit, you've reached the end of yourself and you can't do any more, that might be the point at which new wine is ready to flow in your life. And it's new wine, it's different wine. It's a different vintage. It's going to look deeper, richer than you could ever have imagined, ever planned for. It's going to be different. It's new wine that Jesus is bringing into your life. It might just be that your situation of struggle is the doorway into the blessing that God wants to bring in your life. We heard a wonderful talk as a staff team a couple of weeks ago from a lady called Damalola. She's a pastor down in London. Damalola McCady, and she said this, crisis moments are disproportionate in their formative capacity. Crisis moments are disproportionate in their formative capacity. I don't know what tough thing you're going through today, but may you know today, may you know that as the wine runs out, Jesus longs to bring the new wine of his kingdom. May you taste that wine and may you find it to be good.